LSAT Demon Daily. I'm Nathan Fox, founder of the LSAT Demon, and with me is Chandra Monday, an actual lawyer. Chandra, how are you?
I'm good.
Those are beautiful flowers behind you. What kind of flowers are those?
Those are hydrangeas. I bought them for myself this Mother's Day weekend. I did get a gift from my family that I loved, but I was in the store shopping and they had a lovely display and I love hydrangeas. So I just said, I'm getting this for myself.
That is very smart of you. Just in case they totally botch it, you
can... Exactly.
Okay, so Chandra today is... a product manager. She's in the insurance industry, and she has a background in electrical engineering, then went to Columbia Law School. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. Then practiced in big law.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually transitioned into in-house counsel.
Corporate in-house.
And then now has moved over to the product side. So maybe... let's see. Yeah, electrical engineering is not the most common undergraduate degree. Of course, when someone says that they studied electrical engineering at Harvard, especially, I tend to think they can probably do whatever they want in the world. But
thank you.
why electrical engineering?
So I would say it was probably my risk aversion in terms of future careers. So my parents, wonderful folks, and they are also college educated, and they had liberal arts degrees, and we always had money issues, and so science was the path that I decided would give me more and better career options. And when I was in school, in grade school, and in high school, I had a lot of wonderful math teachers, and I got a lot of great encouragement from them. So in high school, I had an internship at our NASA facility. It was a high school internship for high schoolers, and I worked under an electrical engineer. And so I really liked her. The experiment we were doing was pretty cool. And so I decided that was going to be my major in college. Fast forward to college, and it was a good experience, but I wasn't really enjoying it on a day-to-day level. I think my personality type and the personality type of a lot of engineers, the kind of average engineer, I would say, is more introverted. And I felt like we had a lot of work that was kind of lab-based, isolated, and it was a very kind of solitary experience for me.
Okay.
So I just kind of got, you know, to the point where I finished the degree, but I didn't want to work in the field.
Gotcha. All right. And so not wanting to work in that tech field, you then ended up right out of college going to McKinsey?
No. Oh, yes, right out of college, yes, McKinsey, but not law school. So
right.
I intentionally waited a few years to go to law school, and I knew I wanted some broad work experience. And my city, I'm in Cleveland, and my city had a McKinsey office, and I got in contact, the recruiter and I got in contact, and they had a summer internship. So I did a summer internship there, and I liked it a lot. It's good, like broad project-based experience. And so the program, out of the internship, I got a job offer, and the job after college was specifically a two-year job. And so a lot of people who did that job would go to business school and then come back. But I knew going in I wanted to go to law school. The law is also very analytic, so that's kind of – engineering and law are different fields, but they both are very logic-driven, analytic-driven. And so I knew that was what I wanted to do based on the fact that I kind of enjoyed – a course I took in college that was a cross-registered course with the law school, and I enjoyed my government classes, and I've always kind of been not argumentative, but I like to kind of take positions and advocate. So I knew that was what I wanted to do, but I didn't want to go straight through because that was kind of my college experience was a lot of work, and I needed some time to kind of find myself before going back to school.
And you thought McKinsey was a good bridge to law school.
It was. I mean, the nice thing about that job out of college is they expect you to go off to grad school, and you can either return or not. So it's a good launch pad for your next phase, whatever it's going to be.
Okay. Did they have you work in the consultants that I have known? They work like 100 hours a week and then they have 3 weeks off. Was that how it was when you were at McKinsey?
No. I mean, I didn't have 100-hour weeks, but we would go on the road. I mean, we definitely worked a lot, but we would go on the road 4 days a week and then Fridays in the office. And if you had a vacation scheduled, they honored that, but it's very project based. So, I mean, sometimes there was time between projects, but I was there in 99 to 01, and that was when I believe the dot-com bubble burst. And that was right before I went off to law school. So there's kind of a phrase called on the beach, which means like you don't have an active project. So towards the end of that time, things slowed down a little bit. And so I had like a couple of in-between times for projects, but it was nice because I was going to grad school. So it worked out really well. It was a great experience, honestly. It was great. The people were great. The travel was probably a bit much for me, so I knew ultimately I wouldn't stay in that field forever, but it was really great exposure to a lot of kind of business issues.
What was it like, first flight out on Monday and then fly back Thursday night?
Exactly. That's exactly right. Or if your client was drivable, driving there,
Drive 7 hours
couple
to
hours
get,
away. Not that far. The furthest drive was like 3 hours, so I would get on a plane if it was
Got
more than a half a day.
it. Got it. Cool. Okay, so let's see. You're at McKinsey and you start prepping for the LSAT, applying to law school
Yep, I was
at the
studying
same
for the
time.
LSAT.
Take your
I did
books
all
with you on the road.
self-study. On the weekends, I would do it on the weekends. I
Okay.
didn't take them with me on trips, but I
Too
did it on the
much
weekends.
when you're out on a project.
Yeah.
Okay. All
Yeah.
right, so you just studied for the LSAT on the weekends. That's not what we normally recommend.
No, I agree. And actually, I think so. I did pretty well. I didn't get into every law school that I applied to, but when I took a practice test and the actual result, there was only 1 point difference. So I would not recommend self-study, actually. I don't think I advanced the ball, but I wasn't in a place that was too worrisome anyway. So, but I wanted a higher score, yes, but my score was sufficient to get me where I need to be, but I didn't get into a couple of schools as well. So such happens.
Well, I mean, it looks like it worked out fine for you because you ended up at Columbia. But as far as self-study goes, generally, boy, you better have the right resources. And I hope you also have some real smart friends that you can ha ask questions. The ability to ask questions, it's like it's shocking. I mean, our students who ask questions improve. The questions who
Yeah, I
the
didn't do
students
that.
who don't ask questions, it's
It was
hard to
flat.
improve.
Yep, I agree with that. And I did. I used books. Remember going to the bookstore and getting those hard copy books? So I'm dating myself, but I used those books and I would have the practice
Which
test.
are terrible, by the way. I do like a what is it called? I do like a oh God, I'm struggling to find a phrase for it, but it's like I punish myself on purpose. When I'm in a bookstore or a library, I have to go look at the shelf for test prep. And when I look at the shelf for test prep, they have literally the worst books. Because it's like Barron's and
I don't remember what I
Kaplan
used.
and like
Kaplan.
LSAT for Dummies, and it's like they have these, it's like these big national relationships with publishing houses or whatever. And I'm like, okay, I wrote a bunch of LSAT books that I think are much better than these, but I self-published them, and I don't have any relationship to get inside Barnes and Noble or whatever. And
And that's where I went, probably Barnes and Noble.
And I just I think about, sometimes I'll even see like a kid there browsing the shelves and I'm like, oh no, you're about to make such a big mistake because these books just overcomplicate and make it
Yeah,
oh.
I agree. It was dense, and I remember like some of it not feeling like it was intuitive to learn. That's the time I was in at that time. So, and I didn't have time to take a, I felt like I didn't have time to take a class because I was working. So that was part of it too.
Well, I mean, now fortunately everything is online. And yep. So it's a lot easier for people to prep even when they're exactly. traveling. We also now, there's so many free resources. I mean, and not to make this a complete advertisement for my product, but at LSATdemon.com, we have, you can sign up for a free account. You can do everything. You can do full test time sections, watch videos, read written explanations. You can even come. We invite you to live classes on Zoom. You can do so much with just That's a free great. Account. And yeah, we really want to help people like you who are just there just randomly picking some book off of the I shelf. Oh, this must be good. And it turns out that it just
exactly. It, did, it was one point, one single point. Yeah.
God. And you spent so much time on it.
I did.
Yeah, that's a shame. Okay, well, anyway, how many schools did you apply to?
Oh, let's see. Probably about a half dozen or so.
Okay.
Law schools.
That's not enough. And you, for our taste, we really recommend that people apply to like 15 law schools. You only took the LSAT once.
I did.
Also once. Not enough, because law schools only care about your highest score.
Yeah.
And so you could have taken another crack at it.
I didn't
want
to do it again.
No, I get it. And people are like, oh, I don't want to do it again. But see, the thing is, it doesn't work out this well for other people, right? Like, it worked out super well for you because you end up at Columbia and everything is rosy. Although, wait a second.
Or hydrangea-y. Sorry. That was funny.
Wow. I can see why you're buddies with Brittany. Did you... Did you, sorry, Brittany, that was a cheap shot. Did you pay for law school?
I paid part. So I had loans and I had private loans and some financial aid, but mostly loans actually. So, my employer, someone who goes through the analyst program, if you had an offer to come back, they would arrange for private loans for kind of a good portion of the cost. And if you went back to work for them, they would forgive it. But I didn't go back to work for them. I wanted to become a lawyer right away. So they financed part of it. And then I ended up paying them back through a private loan through Citibank. And I also had like the government loans. And I think I had a small amount of grants, but compared to college, it was way more loan financing involved.
So you graduated from Columbia in 2004. Let's see, the tuition at Columbia in 2000, it's now $70,000 a year.
It's a ton. And I feel like the total cost was close to $50,000 a year, even back then, or 40 something a year, like all in with housing and everything.
I mean, still, it's criminal that the tuition has like doubled since 2004. Inflation since 2004 has been what, 1%?
Yeah.
A year. I mean, like nothing, yeah. Right? And they still have just like doubled their tuition since 2004 because there's so many people who are so stupid who are willing to line up and pay for it when they really don't have to. But anyway, you graduated with what, $100,000 of debt?
Yeah, about that, probably. Yeah, yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Okay. And you went straight into big law. Okay. You ended up in big law for 10 years, which I would take it means you didn't have any problem paying those loans back in the grand scheme of things.
I paid a lot of them back. Yes. Yes.
Oh, you still have them?
Well, I have some that were on a longer timeline, but all my private loans are fully paid back.
So you've, okay. So the government ones, those are super low interest ones, rates, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So you've just decided, I don't need to pay those back. I can save money on my own. My retirement account's going to do better than this 2% that I'm paying to the government.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Exactly. But okay. Those are kind of, you know, much smaller than the private loans were.
So by choice, and with you understand like math enough to get what you're doing, you realize like, oh, well, it would actually be kind of dumb for me to pay back this loan that's at such a crazily low interest rate. But you definitely paid back those private loans, which were like 7, 8, 9% interest.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I paid those back in probably less than 5 years. Yeah.
Okay.
I kind of aggressively paid those. Yes.
Okay. Well, it all worked out well for you. I mean, our mission statement is basically don't pay for law school. We just really want people to go just get a scholarship, because the whole scholarship thing these days, I mean, it's just insane.
That's good to know.
They give, can I, you know what, can I tell you actually, I bet you don't know this. I mean, maybe you do, but you've probably never looked at a 509 report, or at least not recently, a 509 report for Columbia University.
Nope.
No? Here, let me chat it to you in Zoom just so you can, okay. Just so you can see what I'm looking at.
Okay.
This is a standard 509 information report, which is required by the American Bar Association for all ABA law schools. They have to produce this every single year, and they hide way down on the bottom right corner.
Of and the first second page. Second page. Okay.
Second page. They put the most important bit, which is grants and scholarships for their class, for their entire school, for the final, for the last year. And what we see is that there are 1,200 students right now at Columbia Law School, all full time, no part time program there.
Yep.
Of those 1,200, 755 are receiving grants. So 61% are getting some discount. And if you keep scrolling down, you'll see that 16% of the class is getting half to full tuition.
That's great.
4% of the class is getting full tuition.
Okay.
And there are a couple lucky souls there who are actually getting more than full tuition. This is not as egregious. So you're like, great. But this is actually the problem, or part of the problem. The reason why Columbia charges nominally, which, where is this information? Is, just to the left there. You see that they are now charging $36,000 a semester. Plus another $2,500 in fees. So, you know, we're talking, boy, it's more than I thought. We're knocking on the door of 80 grand a year. Yep. 80 grand a year to go to Columbia. But part of the problem is you've got a significant chunk of the class that's getting some to all of it paid for by the other students in the class. That's the point, right? And if you go, so Columbia is, you know, so prestigious that they don't really need to do as much merit-based scholarships as other schools do. But boy, when you drop down outside of the top six law schools, you start seeing just wild amounts of tuition scholarships that are, I think, part of the problem, like the reason why they've been able to so wildly inflate their rack rate tuition, is because there'll be schools where it's like 85% of the class is getting some sort of a discount.
Interesting. Aren't colleges also kind of way up compared to kind of back in the early 2000s as well? Isn't that kind of across all schools?
Education period. Yeah. It's like education and healthcare are, you know, they've just totally disconnected from actual inflation. Like the actual cost of money is nothing for these industries that just have, well, hey, and you know what? The other big part of the problem, of course, is you've got this third payer involved that, right? I mean, the reason why healthcare is so expensive is because of this weird relationship between the medical industry and insurance and people, right? Where the people aren't making the actual payments. It's the insurance company that's making the actual payments. And so then it's like you don't get a consumer who can actually go shop.
It's triangulated.
It's triangulated. Thank you. And in law schools, it's just the government willing, you know, Department of Education willing to guarantee these loans. And so, because it is kind of triangulated. I mean, the people blundering into law school don't even realize they're not, like, they're signing a piece of paper, but they're not actually paying. They're just borrowing.
Yeah, true. I borrow right? too. And
so,
yes.
So then they don't care, because they're like, oh, well, you know, I mean, I'm going to be wearing a fancy suit and practicing law when I come out of this. And so, like, paying back the money is going to be absolutely no problem. And for people who end up in big law.
Doctors, too.
Yeah.
Yes.
For people who end up, like, successfully practicing in a high level role, sure, fine, maybe you can grind it out and pay off those loans. The problem is that those loans don't go away if you wash out for whatever reason.
Exactly. And if you don't like it, or if you want to do public interest, or or something, life changes. Yep.
Oh, you get married, you have a kid, you realize that you don't want to be an alcoholic and get a divorce, mm-hmm. and, you know, like all of these things that befall young lawyers in big firms.
Several, not all of them, but yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just an extremely common pitfall, right? And
yeah, it is.
So anyway, we rant about this all the time on the show, but I wanted to show you that 509 report. That is publicly available.
It's a good report,
information
yeah.
for anybody who for any ABA law school, you can get that same information.
Yeah, but, that's good to know.
Okay, anyway. What was it like at Columbia?
I loved it. I really loved it. It was wonderful. So I think for me, the time I spent working and kind of the experience I had undergrad really helped me keep things in perspective as a law student. I loved my classmates. I had a great class. And also I was there from 01 to 04, and our class was pretty, like, we got along pretty well. We had great relationships, but I think something that made our class even more different was we were all there when September 11th happened, and that was the third week of law school. So I think, you know, we kind of went through a lot together. And I liked my professors. I thought that they brought really just good ways of teaching to the table. There were only a couple classes that I didn't like, but it was more because a couple of classes where I had some folks who were pretty have been doing it for decades and decades and decades, and I think we're a little less kind of connected to the young student experience and just life. Like one of my classes, the professor had actually written the textbook, and so he just knew everything, and it was like being talked at rather than talked to. But other than that, like, it was a really great experience. I had some great clinics. I did a clinic where we got to kind of go to our professor's court and kind of spend a day with them, kind of watching the things that came in front of the bench. My criminal law professor was a federal judge. He let us come to his court and kind of sit in the back and watch if we wished to. So I did that once. And so I think they did a nice job of kind of trying their best to show what it was actually like. That said, litigation is the path that's kind of most like law school. The rest of law is not. Like, what I do as a corporate in-house lawyer, what I've done as a corporate in-house lawyer, there's really no real tie to it in law school. There's a little bit, but it doesn't, like, law school is good in terms of teaching you how to break down problems and think about them and analyze them, but it doesn't really teach you for the working real world. It's not that connected to the working real world, but I made great friends. I learned a lot. I had wonderful professors, and I loved being in New York City. And I have a sister who lives in New York City who's there now, and we were living together for a lot of the time. So it was good because I had, you know, kind of a friend network. I had family, and I was an actual adult. So I got to kind of enjoy New York and going out in New York.
So your first job out of law school, was that in New York, or did you end up?
No, I came back to Cleveland. So, okay. I did spend one summer at a law firm in New York, but I got a summer job during one of my other summers at a firm in Cleveland. I knew I wanted to come back home. First of all, kind of the cost of living is a whole different animal.
Right.
And my New York summer experience was good, but I felt like as a person, you have a better experience kind of being who you are in a smaller market than a market like New York Big Law. And I think New York Big Law is even more pressure driven, and it just wasn't what I wanted for me. So I did come back and work here at the law firm where I met Brittany, and I wanted to do that. Like I knew I was very, very certain.
For all the listeners, Brittany, by the way, is Brittany Mullen, who helps us out with operations at LSAT.
So wonderful.
Demon. Yeah, she's great. Cool. Okay, so you were there at that firm for, wow, 10 years. Did you think you were lifer?
No. I did. Like, I got a lot of great experiences there. I also met my husband there. Oh. So that was great. Uh-huh. he's a lawyer, too, but he was working there before he headed off to law school. So he worked there kind of a few years after I got there. He had taken some time off and done some other things as well before he went to law school. And he actually got good scholarships. So he graduated from law school here in town, and they gave him a great scholarship opportunities. And but we met there. So I attribute my marriage to working there. And I had two kids while I was still there, became a mom. So I had some maternity leaves there as well. So part of that time, I had two like generous maternity leaves as well. So I view my time there as a time of phases. The 2008 recession happened while I was working there as well. And I know for a lot of folks that was hard. And I think kind of the way we practiced and the things that we got to work on changed in that a lot of companies put less work in their outside law firms. And so it became more about just the bigger cases. And in big law, a lot of cases take a long time to get to the finish line or trial, or they never get there. And so much of the time is spent in discovery. And as time passed, I think more of the practice became more about discovery than kind of so much time was spent in that. And I was getting bored with it. And also the billable hour is, you know, it's a metric that I think can be tough, and particularly as a parent, it gets harder to kind of be judged by billable hours. So in-house, you're more rewarded for your efficiency. Like in-house, right, or lofts, your kind of outcomes matter, but the secondary metric is kind of in-house, it's more about efficiency, and at firm, it's more about billable hours. So
how old were your kids when you...
Young.
At like the end of your your law firm life, your kids were...
So my daughter was born in 2012. So when I left, my daughter was not yet 2, and my son was 5.
And how many hours were you billing those last couple of years?
I don't remember. Our requirements were close to 2,000 hours, so I made my requirements, but that was kind of like...
You weren't going above and beyond.
It's hard to when you have kids.
Yeah, no, obviously.
It's hard to. So, but it was like I learned a lot and I got good experience, but I also kind of, I was ready for change when it was time to, when I moved on. And in-house is, I think, more... there was more variety in what I was doing once I got in-house, and you're much closer to kind of the forward-looking issues and plans of the companies that you work for and your clients. And of course, litigation is backward-looking. So I think my in-house career has been more exciting as I kind of look at this phase of my legal profession.
Well, I mean, if the law firm is they're like requiring of you and rewarding you for billable hours. In-house, they want to avoid legal expenditures, I'm assuming, as much as possible. So
they want to keep things running smoothly.
There's a difference in priority, I'm sure, the second you move over to in-house. I mean, how many hours a week did you have to work to bill your 1,800 hours?
Oh, gosh.
Or whatever it was.
Yeah, it was more like 19, but 19 something. But
why not just make it around 2000? I mean,
it's like 1950. I don't know. Oh gosh, I don't know. It could vary because I mean, and then also I was involved in different bar association activities.
Okay.
I did a leadership program. So, but I would bring work home and work at night if I needed to. So it varied. And then the times where I did go to trial, I think my biggest billing month was well over three. It was probably like 350, but that's an exception. 350 hours for that month because we were in trial.
Right.
But that's an exception. Like, you're not in trial that much, especially with the bigger cases, because there's so much risk involved. A lot of people don't want to go to trial, so they'll end up settling.
Gotcha. Okay.
But that, yeah. So the outlier was 350. More typical is kind of, you know, kind of close to 200, but under 200.
Did you go to work for a client?
No, actually, no. A company. So I went to work for my first in-house job was a manufacturing company, GE Lighting, based here in Cleveland. And no, they just had an opening, and I did some research on the types of folks that worked there, and the people who hired me were corporate kind of in-house transactional lawyers, but they had been litigators. So my prior company hired me with kind of that, like, we are kind of more interested in the candidates, kind of what they bring to the table overall, and you'll kind of learn. And so it was a good first in-house job because I got trained by people who made that transition from law firm to in-house and changed their practices.
What's the big difference? Or, I mean, was it tough to trans? It sounds like you had lots of guidance, but would it have been tough without that guidance?
Probably somewhat. Yeah. I mean, if they just left me and said, here, go do this. And like, mm-hmm. Yes, but it's doable. It's definitely doable. Like, if I had to figure it out all by myself, I would have to kind of find resources. But reviewing contracts it's time consuming, but you just have to kind of break everything down into smaller portions. Like, you know, don't think of it as a whole contract. Think of it as a collection of clauses. And that's kind of what my manager, you know, taught me. And that is the best way to do it. And it's very, like, logical. And you have to think of, okay, why does this say this? Who wins? Who loses? Or who kind of gets the better outcome if it says this versus making a change? And, you know, do you want the outcome to be more even? Or does the outcome of this clause need to favor us instead of them? So that kind of stuff.
And when you say favor us, you're looking forward to the litigation that might ensue.
Well, just if a problem arises, you always, so lawyers always think in the parade of horribles, like what could go wrong. So
parade of horribles.
For instance, like in a technology contract, you know, what could go wrong is their service shuts down, or, you know, the way they deliver the service is terrible. Uh-huh. What outs do you have? So thinking about what outs you have, or what guarantees you have. Yeah, like I do always think of what can go wrong. I do.
Well, I mean, that my impression of contracts, period. I never practiced law. I went to law school. I don't know anything about it. But my impression of it is this document isn't going to do very much until the only real the force of the document comes from litigation. I mean,
or problems happening. Yes.
Well, a problem happening that might lead to litigation, right? It's like,
yeah, sure.
The only way that this actual document would get enforced on anyone is through a lawsuit.
Sometimes. I mean, I think that...
or threat of a lawsuit, right?
Yeah, like business people talking to each other or working it through. Like, relationships do matter, though.
Sure.
Like, relationships matter, and kind of, you know, people with decision-making authority talking to each other matters. So, you know, sometimes things have to kind of get to the right people to work through, you know, potential friction. So that matters, too. I think most of the time, people want to avoid litigation, honestly.
Right.
Most of the time people want to avoid it.
Of course. And I'm not saying that that like you're going to actually litigate the contract, mm-hmm. but all those clauses and everything that you're talking about, I mean, those clauses are related to litigation.
Yeah, it's, like, yeah, well, it's kind of like, this is what we'll prove based on what
here's what
this
would
says.
Happen if this actually, yeah. if the shit hit the fan. And we're hoping that it exactly. won't, but if it did, exactly. this is what would happen.
These
and
are so our rights.
It's all, exactly. yeah, okay. All right, cool. All right, so you're there for just a couple of years, right?
At GE yeah, Lighting? So it's under 3 years. Yep, yep. And then, so my current company, also based in Cleveland, an insurance company, a friend of mine who had worked at my old law firm, the same one that Brittany worked at, was there. And there was an opening in the area that I focus on, which is contracts. And it's a really great place to work. I'm really happy there. And she said, hey, come on, make the jump over here. So I applied and I got in. So I got to get reunited with one of my very close friends from my old law firm. So again, relationships matter.
Yeah. Was it a promotion? Were you not happy at GE Lighting?
No, I was fine. I was fine. I was happy. The company has since been sold. So growth was a challenge. And I kind of wanted to make sure I had a long career, mm-hmm. you know, at my company and GE writ large. A lot of people kind of move around mm-hmm. to advance their careers, but it was a lateral move. My job was a lateral move, but I'm glad I made it because I think that just the situation is different. The company's in a better position that I'm at now. It's much stronger, and it has a headquarters here, and it just makes sense for me and my family and kind of my goals for stability.
Okay. You know, speaking of your family, you in late 2020, you actually moved out of the legal department.
Yep, I sure did. During the pandemic, I changed jobs and I became a product manager on the business side. Yes, I did. Changing jobs in the pandemic is a scary prospect, I think, but I wanted to kind of do something new, learn a lot more, learn about kind of how insurance products are kind of brought into the market. And it's a more cross-functional role, like that you have to kind of be plugged into all different parts mm-hmm. of the business, and you have so much more of a view of things, and I would say more kind of decision-making authority within your, you know, within your region. So as the legal side, we're more the advisors and the business folks, like, you know, they value the advice, but kind of it's ultimately their call on a lot of stuff. Some things not, but a lot of stuff. And so wanting to wear that hat, not having worn that hat and kind of, you know, have the ability to influence strategy was part of the motivation, and just do different things. I get bored easily. So I would say my job now is one where I'm like right at the beginning of the learning curve.
Yeah. You're planning to be a product manager for the rest of your career, or?
For a while. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long, but for a while. Like, I definitely see myself doing this for some years. How many years? Not sure yet. Okay. But it really kind of depends on where it takes me in terms of, like, interest and passion and you know, day-to-day.
And you're going to keep your license active?
Yeah, I'm active. I'm all my CLEs are current right now. So, yep, I am. I may go back to the law. I mean, when I retire one day, I might want to kind of do something with mediation. So, yeah, and I will always, you know, want to have it active because I will always kind of want that as an option. I think a law degree is a good, if you're going to law school and you know the reason you want to go to law school, it's actually a pretty good generalist foundation because you can do so many things. I mean, the finances of it may sometimes make your choices a little tougher depending on how, but like you say, if you can get scholarships and kind of do it a little differently, then you don't have those considerations. Yeah. So it's a good launch pad to a lot of different opportunities.
That's interesting. That's the irony, I suppose. I mean, we shit on the idea of you can do anything with a law degree when it's used as a sales pitch. I mean, we see the schools all the time you know, they're selling an extremely expensive product that has mm-hmm. not very good outcomes for
like many people,
half of the people who go to law school. And so we're really worried about that, like, hey, y'all are selling this dream and you're just so happy for people who don't know any lawyers, have no idea what legal practice is like, have no idea what they're getting themselves into, and they're going to have $250,000 of debt when they walk out, and you're selling this idea you can do anything with a law degree.
Mm-hmm.
Which but the irony is, if you actually do go practice law, if you have some idea like you did, you had a plan and you ended up like going straight into big law and being an actual lawyer practicing law, after that you are very well equipped to do anything with a law degree,
mm-hmm.
like once you've practiced and hopefully gotten rid of that debt.
Yep, that's accurate. Or if you can, you know, don't have a lot of that debt in the first place, so
somehow avoid the debt in the first place, which is take one of those scholarships that are available instead of, you know, going to a slightly more prestigious school and incurring a crazy mountain of debt that then like really sort of, it's an anchor on you, right? Yeah. It like closes lots of doors.
It does for a lot of people.
If you owe that much money.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Same for college too these days. Like, you know, I think that a lot of college kids are facing that same dilemma.
Oh man. I mean, like I spend my days advising, you know, 21 to 29 year olds mostly. Sometimes younger, sometimes older, but mostly they're 20 somethings who already have a bachelor's, frequently with a mountain of debt, and it's, that ship has already sailed, and I'm advising them about what to do with law school, which is frequently don't go or
don't
pay if you do go. But boy, if I was giving advice to a 18-year-old who's thinking about where to go to college, man, I have a niece who's about to start high school, and when I think about her going off to college, it would scare me if she was signing her life away.
A lot of those loan papers. Yeah.
Well, especially because I know how I was when I was 18 going off to my freshman year of school, and I know how little I got out of it relative to how much, you know, of course I went to college in the 90s, so it wasn't nearly as expensive as it is today.
So
but
did I. Yeah.
For people who are going to law school or going to college these days, you know, if you're
It's like $50,000 a year, 50, 60. Mm-hmm.
And you're such an idiot when you're 18 and you're just like, I don't know. I was such a space cadet in college and I just didn't get nearly as much. I was not getting value for my money. Even though then it was, you know, $14,000 a year, including room and board probably. And it was just not that much still not nothing, but it's not that much compared to college today. I don't know. I just think I'd be telling young people to potentially put off undergrad or go to a community college for a couple of years and figure out what you want to do and get some sort of, I mean, get a job for a while, travel, like whatever, do young person stuff. And then go back to, like, if you have a certain career path, maybe go for it. But boy, like, as far as like, go find yourself in college for $50,000 a year.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I think just be smart about it. Keeping the eyes open and kind of knowing.
But they're not. Young people are not. They're not smart about money, especially.
Some are, but it's not like there's a lot of opportunities to get smart about it that are made available to young people.
Well, the schools aren't going to help.
Yeah.
You know, the schools are going to be like, oh, well, we have generous financial aid packages available. And it's like, financial aid? What if Visa was here telling you about their financial aid package that they have available?
I remember when I was in college, these credit card companies would like, come to this area and just like line up and have their credit card applications like out for people to stand in line and apply for the
predatory credit cards. Give you a free frisbee, you know. And free frisbee. All I gotta do is sign up for this 30% per year credit card so that we can get get you trained up as a lifetime credit card debt customer. I remember that too. Just right there on campus, right outside the bookstore, just like tent after tent after tent. Of course, they pay undergrads, you know. It's like, ooh, that girl's kind of cute. She's there giving the frisbees away and signing you up for a credit card. You know,
it's like a credit card honey trap.
Oh boy. You know, and hey, those credit cards at least had, you know, a $700 limit on them.
I think my first one had like $1,000.
And the schools themselves, though, have a no limit. I mean,
I was lucky enough to have a lot of scholarships in college. So
for undergrad,
I think I only had everything was scholarship except for $4,000 a year. So it was pretty good.
Okay,
it's pretty good.
What's it like being a woman of color in the law?
So in a city like New York, and going to law school there, like it was very, very, it was a great experience. We had folks from all over. We had folks also from other countries in our class. So in a city like New York, it's so diverse that like you don't feel like you're kind of one of a few. And I had a lot of friends that, you know, were outside of law school. My sister was there. So I felt like I had a really good network. And then at my law firm, I was the only Black woman in my group, but I had another friend who was in a different group who also, we were kind of the same class, same tenure, came there at the same time. And then I made a lot of friends like outside the firm. And I had a lot of friends of, you know, kind of all races. So for me, I had great relationships, but I would say there weren't a lot of examples of kind of getting to that higher level or that partner level. So that was where I think the experience is a little bit more of an outlier because you don't see as many people like you at those levels. But I did have a friend who I had a couple partner friends at other law firms. So I had those role models, but I had to look further than I would say people others had to look, because like those kind of examples and role models, you know, were a little closer to them. So you just have to kind of like expand out to the next sphere to look for those examples and models and to stay connected to where those examples are.
Okay. I guess, I mean, I want to ask for your advice for law students of color. In New York, you didn't have much of a problem, but law students of color in, I don't know, Sacramento. What might you recommend?
I would say look to like the bar associations. There are a lot of cities that have African-American bar associations, and you know, they'll often be named after lawyers who have a connection to maybe that city or that market. So like ours in our city is called the Norman Minor Bar Association. So you can make connections there, and they often have ways to connect with law students. I would also say look for alum. And in general, law students face the worst time in law school when they kind of close off and isolate themselves, like no matter their background. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the folks who kind of just go to the library, put their head down and study and don't really reach out. So always kind of be making those reach outs is what I would say.
How?
It's asking people who they know, like, do they know other folks? Are there any alum who, you know, are there any Black alum who went to this school who are doing, you know, something in whatever field or area of law you might be interested in? I think all law schools should have an alumni office or alumni association. So that's a good way as well. And, you know, law school is very busy, but I've been someone who's volunteered a lot over the years. So you can kind of build connections through volunteer work as well. I did like volunteer work through our legal aid association here when I was a younger lawyer. Don't do as much volunteering now, I must say, but life has gotten pretty busy. But you can meet people and kind of get plugged in, and your experience will kind of feel more meaningful in general. I mean, those role models may not always be there. Professors as well, like if there are professors that, you know, are kind of interesting or you want to build a connection with, you can like kind of learn more about them, learn about like their career or kind of what they see. I was, as an undergrad, I was a very kind of reserved and timid student. And over the years, I've gotten, you know, I've gained a lot more self-confidence, and it's hard to have a lot of self-confidence in your 20s. And as a teen going into your 20s, but be unafraid. And if you're truly miserable, then don't be afraid to kind of change something up and walk away.
I love that. I give similar advice to my LSAT classes all the time. It's like, hey, man, you're going to be a lawyer. You're not, you better be willing to speak up. A lawyer is an advocate. You got to advocate for yourself first. Like, you don't understand something, you better tell me you don't understand it. Or if there's something that's not working out, you better say, hey, this isn't working for me. It is just not a place for the shy, really.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's okay to be, you know, reserved or kind of pick your words or when you feel the need to, but there's always going to be a time where you kind of need to have your voice ready. So
want to be, that's okay. You don't have to be the person who talks all the time. Matter of fact, the people who talk all the time frequently just nobody listens to them. They don't know what they're the talking about. The gunners. Yeah, exactly. The ones who raise their hand every day in the first semester of 1L, they're constantly speaking, volunteering for everything, and then they get their grades back after the first semester, and then they don't say anything in the second semester.
Those are our gunners still favorite. Got good grades, but
some of the ones who do get good grades, they keep talking.
The ones
who don't, you can see they just sort of fade into the background. Oh, that dude, he like dominated the first semester. Wow, how come he doesn't talk? I thought he was like so smart. No, he got all B's. You want to be the person, you do want to speak sometimes though, and you want to be the one that people listen to when you do actually chime in, right? I mean, if you're in the room and you don't say anything because everything's going fine, that's fine. Sit there for 45 minutes and don't say anything because it's all going okay. But when you see something that isn't okay with you, or there's a question, you got something you don't understand, then you better be ready to speak up. And hopefully at that point, you'll have the authority by virtue of the fact that you haven't been dominating the conversation for the last 45 minutes. Now, when you do say something, people owe it to you to listen. But you can't just not say anything ever. That ain't going to get it done.
Exactly.
Anything you wish you had known before going into law school and the legal profession?
I think what I might have done is kind of felt comfortable being myself sooner. And law school, no, I wouldn't change a thing. I kind of wish I had gotten an MBA too.
Really?
So like now that I kind of wish the JD MBA program would have just been one more year, but that's so niche. That's not really useful to any of you, you know, the folks who are listening. It's not useful. That's just kind of my particular situation.
Again, it's the irony of if you know what you're going to do with it, then great.
Yeah.
But like, there's so many kids who are, you know, they're 22. They just graduated from undergrad and they're like, I'm looking for JD MBA programs because that's gonna situate me for anything. And it's like, are you kidding me?
Listen,
if you want to be a lawyer and practice law, then get a JD. If you don't want to be a lawyer and practice law, then don't get a JD. If you don't know what you're doing in life, don't get a JD or an MBA.
If you don't know what you're doing, it's so expensive. But I think if I had to change anything, I'd actually maybe change after undergrad or change undergrad, and I might not have majored in engineering because I found that it wasn't my true passion. But I'm glad I took the path I took.
Well, you didn't know, right? I mean, was there some...
exactly.
Did you have a thing? Could you have known and switched?
No, I don't think so. I'm envious of people who are risk takers, though, because, again, like, I came out of college when the dot-com, you know, craze started. Then the bubble burst a little bit, but still, like, I feel like folks who had that foresight to join the dot-com, you know, experience in the tech world back then, like, it's pretty exciting. Like, they were really right on the forefront of that. But that's, you know, like, that's who has a crystal ball. So nobody has a crystal ball.
You don't wish you worked at Facebook.
No, not at all. Okay. No, but I think that, that kind of like what was happening in technology was pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And just like the experience of what folks with engineering degrees did out of my college. So that's kind of the alternate parallel universe that I sometimes imagine. But, and I think lawyers in general are more risk averse, and that is my personality.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Well, we're about to wrap it up. Brittany wanted me to ask you what books you're reading right now.
Oh, okay. Let's see. So not right now, but a recent book that I completed. So I read Isabel Wilkerson's book Caste this summer on kind of America and our history and race. And that was probably the read that was the most meaningful to me over the summer. It's a good like historic look. And it also kind of takes the experience of Germany and kind of compares it with America and also India. So it uses three different countries and kind of parallels and contrasts those. So it's a good, like, people who want to get into history and heavy topics. And I've read that probably around the time George Floyd happened. So it was a lot of like racial reckoning happening in the US. And then for light reads, let's see. A friend of mine, actually, she wrote a book. A friend of mine who went to Columbia Law School with me and who practiced as a lawyer, but she's now an author. And she wrote a like young adult romance book. So I read her book and it was really enjoyable. I really enjoyed it. It's called Love Boat Taipei, but as an example of kind of what things that lawyers do. She did a book tour. I think it was virtual because of the pandemic. But so that was a recent recent fiction read. I read a lot of nonfiction. Like I'm listening right now to Obama's autobiography on Audible. It's probably too dense for me to read it as a book, but I'm you know in the first third of that right now. But it's been taking me a while because I go to it when I have a moment. So
when you're not using Audible, are you a physical books or a Kindle girl?
Kindle now, yeah. But I used to be physical books. I used to be physical books.
Why the Kindle? Which one do you have?
I have the Paperweight. Mm-hmm. The Paperweight was a Paperweight or Paperweight, but that one. I actually used to put the Kindle app on my iPad, but it's too much glare.
Right.
Yeah.
Paperwhite's cool because you can actually read in bed without it lighting up the whole room and blasting
exactly.
You in the
That's
face.
That's what I like.
With the blue That's light. What I like.
Yeah. That's what I like. And I also read Where the Crawdads Sing. That was another fiction book that I read.
Okay.
So it was good. Lots. Although I didn't like it as much as everybody's been saying.
Oh. Tick the box, but didn't really love it that much. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Cool.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners?
I would say don't get discouraged, but face reality. So face reality, but don't get discouraged.
What's
so
that mean?
Understand. So don't have a romanticized notion of where law school is going to kind of lead you. Like, make sure you know why you're going into it. Like, if you have no idea at all why, then don't do it. But if you have kind of a picture of options and kind of where your options might realistically lead and kind of recognize the cost benefit of it, then that's the right mindset. Yeah. And I enjoyed law school. Like I actually enjoyed it. I enjoyed my classes. I enjoyed my professors. And I found it fun. if it's a chore and you hate it, like absolutely hate it, yes, the practice isn't like it, but if you just absolutely hate it and it's the worst thing ever and you're completely miserable, then perhaps rethink it.
I say the same thing about the LSAT. I mean, for sure, if you find yourself in law school as a 1L and you absolutely hate it, you should probably just drop out right there. Because it's like, it's not going to get more fun in your 2L or 3L year. It's like your
3L year was more fun, but my 3L year, I took this one class called, what was it called? Prosecuting Violent Gangs. And our professor was someone who was like a federal prosecutor, and he did all these like RICO cases mm-hmm. in New York. So he had a lot of stories. And when you make it through first year and second year, you can take, you know, what would be considered law electives. Those are fun. Those are fun. That's when you get the real fun stuff.
Okay. But you also didn't hate the background stuff.
No,
I mean,
not at all.
You know,
I liked it.
I just don't think, like, as someone who I did personally hate the background stuff, like I kind of barely did okay my first semester. And I was like, oh man, this is pretty dry. I wasn't digging it. And I thought that like my 2L electives were going to be different, but it was like much more of the same. You know,
that's very fair.
And it got kind of worse and worse. And I just, it's okay to drop out in your 1L year if you're really hating it, and if your grades are terrible, which they will be if you're really hating it, then, you know, I don't think you need to throw good money after bad.
That's fair.
And I'm not referring to just money either. I'm referring to your life, like time
and energy.
It matters a
lot. Brain space.
And with the LSAT, you know, well, I don't know. You can tell me, Chandra, but your self-study for the LSAT.
Nathan, come on, man. That didn't work. I mean, it worked in that I was fine. Like, my score was fine, but it didn't elevate.
No, but my question is, did you hate the law school admission test?
No.
See?
I didn't.
I knew that you were going to say that. I knew you were going to say that because my point is that you read the questions and you figured lots of them out and you did pretty well on the test kind of naturally. And then your prep didn't work out because you did kind of like mm-hmm. the wrong sort of prep. But when you were doing the law school admission test itself, when you were doing reading comprehension or you're doing logical reasoning or even on the games, you're mm-hmm. able to read it, understand it mostly, get most of them right, feel fairly good about it. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it was an interesting challenge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not the worst
like
thing
brain,
you ever did.
Brain cracker, brain teaser.
Puzzle. Yeah. A fun puzzle to do.
And I love puzzles.
A crossword, mm-hmm. Sudoku. Mm-hmm. You like that type
of
thing?
I yes, love that. Yes, course. I do. I like Sudoku and puzzles, actual puzzles.
Yeah. I mean, that's... I guess my point is just that, like, if you hate the law school admission test, like, it's so miserable to you. And because we just hear this from students, and it's like, man, really? You can stop. You don't have to keep going.
It's not mandatory that you do this.
You do not. There's lots of other things you could do out there in the world besides go to law school and practice law. And if you're not digging it now...
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Because it gets harder. It gets harder. The days get longer. The billable hours get more intense.
Yeah.
Yes.
People, it's true. Well, because I mean, our students, Chandra, like many of the most naive ones, you know, they view the LSAT as a thing that they have to, I just got to get past this one thing. Once I get past this, then it's all going to be easy.
It's nothing compared to the bar exam. The bar exam is a whole different animal.
You took the New York bar, right?
No,
I didn't. Sorry, Ohio bar.
I took the Ohio bar. Yeah, it was a 2.5-day bar exam.
Is it still?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. How?
As far as I know, I think so, yeah.
How did you study for it?
Class. Barbary class.
Barbary.
Every day. In person.
6 days a week?
A big lecture hall.
5 days a week?
5 days a week, yep. 5 days a week
for that whole summer.
Yep, the whole summer. Yep, it was good though. It was a good experience. I knew I was like, I only want to take this once. So I was definitely taking the class that time around. No self-study there. Yeah, I knew.
Yeah.
I knew.
Were you on pins and needles waiting for your results, or did you feel pretty good about it?
I was kind of, I don't know. I was at peace, I think, because I knew I had done kind of everything that I could do. So I was like, well, the result's going to be the result of everything that I could possibly have done, you know, so.
Excellent. Okay. I'll let you have the last word. Anything else for our listeners?
I would just say that it's a journey. It's not a quick sprint. The law is a long journey. And you have to also have a life and be who you are as a person. So if you feel like, you know, the career, the profession, the education is kind of removing your ability to kind of fulfill yourself as a person or experience things that you need for yourself and that meet your goals, then think about other options. But the law is also can be a very rewarding experience as well. You're going to be intellectually challenged. You're going to meet lots of people who are just, you know, you're kind of in awe of kind of what they bring to bear because there's all kinds of people in the law. So it runs the gamut. You'll see people who you're less in awe of, but you'll have a lot of people to kind of look up to as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Chandra, for coming on the show. Chandra Munday is an actual lawyer and now a product manager for an insurance company in Cleveland, Ohio.
Thanks, Nathan. This has been good. Take care.